criminals or demons. Durvasa Muni was certainly a powerful Brahmana, but his acts against the pure devotee Maharaj Ambarish were no better than the activities of the Asuras. As stated, excuse me, as stated in the Shastras, Dharman tu sakshat bhagavat pranitam. The word dharma refers to the orders or laws given by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Sarva dharman parityaja mamekam sharanam braja. Real dharma is surrender to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Therefore, real dharma means bhakti, or devotional service to the Lord. The Sudarshan Chakra is here addressed as Dharmasetave, the protector of dharma. Maharaj Ambarish was a truly religious person, and consequently, for his protection, the Sudarshan Chakra was ready to punish even such a strict brahmana as Durvasa Muni, because he had acted like a demon. There are demons even in the form of brahmanas. Therefore, the Sudarshan Chakra does not discriminate between the brahmana demons and the shudra demons. Anyone against the Supreme Personality of Godhead and his devotees is called a demon. In the Shastras, we find many brahmanas and kshatriyas who acted as demons and have been described as demons. According to the verdict of the Shastras, one has to be understood according to his symptoms. If one is born of a Brahmana father, but his symptoms are demoniac, he's regarded as a demon. The Sudarshan Chakra is always concerned with annihilating the demons, and therefore he is described as Adharma Shila Suradhuma Ketave. Those who are not devotees are called Adharma Shila. And Sudarshan Chakra is just like an inauspicious comet for all such demons. Om Jnanatmirandhasya Jnanam Janashalakaya Chakshur Unmilitam Jaina Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Mukam Karoti Vachalam Pangum Langhayate Girim Jat Kripa Tamaham Bande Shri Gurun Dinataranam Nama Om Vishnupadaya Krishna Preshtaya Bhutale Srimate Bhaktivedanta Swamini Tinamine Namaste Saraswate Deve Gauravani Pracharini Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschat Yadesha Tarinam Pancha kalpatarubhyascha kripa sindhobhya evacha patitanam pavanebhyo vaishnavebhyo namo namaha. Namasunabha kila dharmasetave hiadharma shila suradhuma ketave trilokya gopaya vishuddhavarchase manojavaya adbhuta karmane grane. O Sudarshan, you have a very auspicious hub, and therefore you are the upholder of all religion. You are just like an inauspicious comet for the irreligious demons. Indeed, you are the maintainer of all the three worlds. You are full of transcendental effulgence. You are as quick as the mind, and you are able to work wonders. I can simply utter the word Namaha, offering all obeisances unto you. So Sudarshan means auspicious vision or good vision. He sees rightly, and here Srila Prabhupada describes it a little differently from the way he's described it in previous purports. It's equal vision. And no matter how you're dressed up, no matter what kind of badges you're wearing, no matter what kind of rank you might have in this world, if you act like a demon, Sudarshan sees you as a demon and treats you as a demon. So this Sudarshan is very... very auspicious for the world, seemingly, apparently inauspicious for the demoniac, but actually auspicious for the entire world. In San Diego, I can't remember whether it's actually in San Diego or perhaps in La Jolla, just off of one of the big freeways coming down from Los Angeles, the Interstate 5, some years ago, maybe 15 years or so ago, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints built one of their temples. It's not one of their like church places, but it's a temple. It's like a place where they go and do all their special rituals and things. They built a temple on some property just off the Interstate 5. So whenever you're coming down the Interstate 5 or going up the Interstate 5, you see the spire of this Mormon temple with, I can't remember which angel they usually have. Is it Moroni? That they put on the top of the thing with a trumpet, gold plated Moroni. So I remember when they built that temple, I just thought, dang, that's where we should have had a temple, with a big dome, with a great big gold plated Sudarshan Chakra, because it would be so. How many? In the course of a year, how many millions of discrete persons, different persons, actually drive past that place every, during the course of a year? It would be a wonderful blessing. Anyway, it didn't happen. They did it. So anyway, the Sudarshan Chakra is so auspicious. Because I was thinking over the last few days, for some reason, even though the New Galaxy Shore Prabhu's email from last month or from earlier this month said that I was to speak on text 6. Somehow or other, I kept looking at the purport to text 5. But and then I realized last night, actually, when I came back from work, it was actually text 6, and that I needed to reconsider what I might do. And I'm particularly constrained by the clock today because I have to get the car back. So I will try very hard to be actually uncharacteristically brief. That wasn't actually a laugh line, but then it wasn't intended as a laugh line, but I realize now that it was. If we take a look back at yesterday's purport, I want to take a little liberty to go somewhere a little different from where Ramiya went. I was listening to his class with great interest to see if he did something like this, and he didn't. He sort of leaned in that direction for a moment and then went somewhere else, and then he had this wonderful pastimes of Sudarshan Chakra. So Srila Prabhupada says, Sudarshan means auspicious vision. From Vedic instructions, we understand that this material world is created by the glance of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Sa-akshita sa-asrija, sa-asrijataha, asrijata. The Supreme Personality of Godhead glanced over the Mahatattva, the total material energy, and when it was agitated, everything came into existence. Western philosophers sometimes think that the original cause of creation was a chunk that exploded. If one thinks of this chunk as the total material energy, the Mahatattva, then one can understand that the chunk was agitated by the glance of the Lord, and thus the Lord's glance is the original cause of material creation. So Srila Prabhupada here, and this is a very good move in argumentation, in argument. I'm conceding something. He's not going to pick some big bone about whether, ultimately, they kind of say something comes from nothing, and that was actually what you might call a bone of contention with Srila Prabhupada. Where do we have such experience that something comes from nothing? And ultimately, the issue that Srila Prabhupada had with the scientists was the influence on society of the so-called scientific thinking, but as I've mentioned before, is actually more properly referred to as scientistic thinking. Science is the search for knowledge, trying to understand things, and scientism is the idea that nothing that cannot be known through the empiric method is worth knowing, is either knowable or worth knowing. And so it all boils down to this positivistic idea of whatever knowledge is worthwhile is what we're able to perceive with our senses and conceive of with the mind and kind of analyze with our mind, as if these things were the crown of creation. One of the people who said it most succinctly was Bertrand Russell. He said, "What science cannot tell us, mankind cannot know." And he might have gone, more recently, he might have gone even a little further and said, isn't worth mankind's knowing. And it's these things have been reduced to in our modern culture, to especially over the last 300 or 400 years since the Renaissance and then the Scientific Revolution, anything that's outside, that's beyond the ken of the senses in the mind, beyond their ability to perceive and understand, is just reduced to superstition. It's labeled superstition. We don't have to bother with it. It's nonsense. Absolute. It's just complete nonsense. Now, the scientistic, what some scholars call the modern Western mindset, it comes from this epistemology, this way of knowing the world, that the only way we can know anything that's worth knowing is by using our senses and our minds to try to see and understand what's there. And the behavior that comes from such epistemology, cultures actually are generated from epistemologies, from our ways of seeing the world. And the culture that's come from that is a culture that's bent on control. It's aimed at control. And we want to for example, we want to control the weather. Or was it Mark Twain who said everyone talks about the weather, but no one does anything about it? Because, frankly, it's superior to us. It's bigger than we are. What can we do about it? We may think we're hot stuff, that we can climb Mount Everest, but we can't do a darn thing about the storm that comes while we're up there in that precarious place. We may think that we're really hot stuff, that we can make a surfboard out of a couple of different kinds of plastic and harness to some small extent the energy, this great energy created in the ocean that makes these waves. But if a quadruple or quintuple overhead wave closes out on us or sucks us over the falls, our foolishness becomes patently obvious even to us. And we think that we can make life better in this modern world, because we've found that there are these things going on, these substances under the earth that we can use to create energy, we've made life so much better. But how's that whole oil thing working out for us now, we might ask. If you live along the Gulf Coast, or perhaps a little later into the future up the Atlantic coast, probably not so well. And if you make your living somehow or other in the Gulf Coast or along the Gulf Coast, probably not so well. The whole place has been completely poisoned by the oil that's leaked into the ocean, as well as, and probably compounded many more times by, the toxic chemicals that were sprayed to disperse it from the surface, so that nobody can tell how bad the thing really is. So whole ecosystems are very likely to have been destroyed by this. So it doesn't work out very well. The things that are outside the ken of this scientific epistemology are things that actually make us human, that actually make life worth living. Things like intrinsic and normative values, purpose. I mean, people have tried to deny, religious studies scholars have tried to deny teleology, any kind of purposefulness in existence, much less religion. Things like global and existential meaning, quality, just quality in life, things that are really a little hard to measure. And the thing is that we can only control what's inferior to us, and whatever is superior to us, we just have decided not to deal with. So we have pretty much made ourselves, as is often said, the crown of creation. And I remember when I thought of that term, it was reminded of something from the late 1960s. There was a musical group called the Jefferson Airplane, and one of their songs was "Crown of Creation." It was a critique of this idea that, you know, we are actually on the top of the heap. We are the culmination of everything that ever will be. And those of us who are old enough may remember the cover art on that. It was a record. This is a very strange word for people under a certain age. On the cover of this record, this LP, vinyl LP record. Does anybody remember what that cover art was on Jefferson Airplane's Crown of Creation? If you don't, you earn 5 bonus points. If you do, you join the Hall of Shame, like me. It was a thermonuclear explosion. Very glorious red, yellow and orange and red thermonuclear explosion, which, you know, is one of our great creations, as Srila Prabhupada alluded to in the purports that we were looking at more recently. So this is the modern Western mindset. It's essentially a materialistic mindset, although there are distinctions. Some people, Houston Smith, one of the most prominent religious scholars of the 20th century, Professor Houston Smith, suggests that their perspective isn't really materialism, because materialism means nothing but matter exists. And you may be able to argue as to whether that's what people really mean. I remember a long time ago when I was in college, I took a philosophy course, introduction to philosophy course, and the final exam was an essay defending the philosophy of materialism. So in the course of 2 hours, I wrote a few pages explaining and defending the philosophy of materialism, that nothing but matter exists and that consciousness is simply a combination of different elements of matter. And then I took a few more pages and completely took that apart and flushed it down the toilet. And my philosophy professor, Will Griffiths, really nice guy who was very friendly to devotees. Actually, he lived across the road from us when we lived out in the country on Maui, and would sit out on his front porch on Sunday evenings and listen to the kirtan. Too bad he didn't come across the road and join it. But he actually had quite a few of Srila Prabhupada's books on his shelf in his office, and no doubt more at home. He had read many of Srila Prabhupada's books, and he loved that final exam. He said, "This is the war and peace of all my philosophy 101 finals," or something like that. Because it was long, but it was also, I mean, I just went to town. I showed him that I understood it, and then I just ripped into it using Srila Prabhupada's arguments. So what Smith suggests is that their idea could really more properly be called naturalism, which means that not that nothing exists but matter, but that nothing that lacks a material component exists, and then in what does exist, the physical component kind of has the final say, has the final word. I think it's splitting hairs. I would call it materialism light, because ultimately, all that matters is matter, is what we can perceive with our senses and understand with our minds. But what we see, and it gives us the kind of culture that we see we have now. It's a horrible place to live. We keep trying to adjust things in order to make it nice, but the fact is that it's not nice. You create some little compound here. Just like, I haven't been to India for a very long time, but I'm guessing things might be different only by degrees, and perhaps the degrees, the extremity of the degrees has increased on both ends. But I remember being driving around Bombay, Mumbai, and seeing these grams, you know, these subdivisions with the big walls built around them, and nice upper middle class homes in them, and then even more the palaces, these mansions that can only really be called palaces. But just outside the walls, cardboard box shanty towns. People with nothing. And I guess this was made somewhat famous by some, I haven't seen this movie. What was that movie a couple of years ago? Huh? Oh, yeah, Slumdog Millionaire. I've seen the most famous video, I think, the Jai Ho video, but I haven't seen the movie. But I think that contrast was kind of brought out in that, from what I understand, was kind of brought out in that movie. So we have pockets of places where things are really nice, and then there, it just makes the rest of the world look even more miserable than it really is. So we've taken the traditional way of seeing the world, in which transcendence is the seed and everything else grows from that. By transcendence, we mean things that are superior to us in every way that we can measure and some that we can't, some that we're unaware of. So in the worldview that comes from this epistemology, this materialistic, naturalistic, scientistic epistemology, is that, you know, everything comes from something meaner than it. We have evolved from some lower sort of animals. And some philosophers observe that it's really interesting that ours is the only culture that says that we have ascended from savages. Because the traditional cultures all held that we descended from gods. That we were created by beings and controlled by beings inestimably, immeasurably superior to us. And now we don't have any room for such an idea. So we've got a culture that's actually inimical to what's suggested in today's purport. That the essence of religion, the essence of human duty is sarva dharman parityajamami kam sharanam vraja. To give up all other sense of what has value and understand that what has real value is taking complete shelter of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And we come back to Bob Rue's Sharanagati riff. And ultimately, that is the essence of Srimad Bhagavatam. That's where Bhagavad Gita ends, that's where Srimad Bhagavatam begins, and that is the thread that runs throughout Srimad Bhagavatam. That, as we see, I don't know if I have time, I wanted to move from this one worldview to the polar opposite worldview. The worldview of the of Bhagavad Gita, where in the seventh chapter, Krishna says, I'm not going to read the Sanskrit, although I love them. Earth, water, fire, ether, mind, intelligence, and false ego, all together, these eight constitute my separated material energies. And besides these, there's another superior energy of mine, which is the living entities. But because we're superior to matter, we try to manipulate it, we try to control it, to meet our own ends, who are exploiting the resources of this material inferior nature. And then he says, in the seventh verse, he says, O conqueror of wealth, there is no truth superior to me. Everything rests upon me as pearls are strung on a thread. He is the one thing that makes everything coherent and makes everything comprehensible. And without that, it flat out just doesn't make sense. So we end up with this modern and postmodern there's a postmodern Western mindset that's replaced that modern Western mindset in which everything is relative. And what do we say nowadays? It's all good. So Srila Prabhupada's, part of Srila Prabhupada's mission was to take on this whole atheistic, materialistic mindset, whether it's materialistic light or materialistic proper. And challenge it. So we need to try to make whatever connections we can, not just be anti-intellectuals, not be content with that, but to try to find whatever connections we can and do what we can to undermine people's faith in this atheistic mindset. Houston Smith says that what it all does is it devolves to a cold, impersonal existence, where there really isn't anything. I mean, ultimately, if there's nothing but matter, then there's not really us. We're just things running around bumping, and so it doesn't matter what I do to you. In the ultimate issue, it doesn't matter what I do to you, because it'll all come out in the wash. You know? After I die, there's nothing to be held accountable for the horrible things that I've done in this life. So I might as well, as they used to say in the old commercial, go for all the gusto I can get. If there's any brief discussion, I welcome it.
Hare Krishna. Is it on? Real quick one. You were talking about creation and so forth, and the kind of like the Big Bang thing. And I was wondering, is there any room in our philosophy to think of, you know, we always see these images of Mahavishnu, you know, and all these universal creations coming out of the pores of his body. So, in a sense, couldn't that be perceived as kind of an explosion? You know, I mean, couldn't it be seen
sure.
that way?
Sure, I don't...
I mean, you know, the scientists, they have this idea of an explosion, so couldn't that be mimic, you know, because it once those ingredients come out, then they begin expanding. An explosion means kind of expanding.
We could concede, it's easy to concede that that could very well be the case, and that all that we can perceive of it is the material, you know, the external material manifestation of that, and we can't see the source. They say it came from a singularity, which is goodness only knows what variety of nothing or something. It's something they made up anyway to try to lend some coherence to their explanation. So why couldn't what they call the Big Bang be these universes expanding from the pores of Mahavishnu? I mean, after all, this is a poetic presentation. You know, this whole Mahavishnu thing, it's not that it's not real, it's not that it's not true, but it's a poetic presentation of how everything came to be. And I was looking at this verse, and we've got completely different translations of Dharmasetave. In the word for word, it says, whose spokes are to be considered a breach of the entire universe. And in the translation, it says, upholder of all religion. And that kind of brings us forward to the end of the 33rd chapter, I think, of the 10th canto, the Rasa dance, where Maharaj Parikit refers to Krishna as Dharmasetu, the upholder of all religion, and how is it that he was dallying with other people's wives. So that's, and I was looking at that, and I was thinking, what do I make of that? And the thing is, this is presented in poetry. And poetic language is extremely dense, like a singularity, like a black hole. And we've always told our students, don't just sit down and read through the stanzas and think that you've gotten a poem. Curl up in front of the fire with a cup of hot cocoa and just kind of immerse yourself in the poem and let it, you know, take your life over and try to figure out all the things that it might be, might say, because there's so much going on in this one verse. So I think there's not necessarily any harm if someone has a good sense how to do that in a way that's not actually compromising our perspective as well. Yes, sir.
Hi, well, I'm not sir, I'm just old choosing on. It's a great talk which you gave. And well, also after an explosion there's chaos. If you admit that there's an explosion, a big bang, but there's so much order. And what you were saying about the Mormon temple, we are preaching Krishna consciousness to bring people to love of Godhead. Most of the other religions do it to have dominion over others. And all around Bombay, they put on the hills, the Catholic Church put crosses to look like we are over all the land. You know. And then Muslims and Hindus go up and knock them down. The Muslims, my expression is they have an edifice complex. On top of every Hindu holy place, they put a mosque. on top of King Solomon's temple, Jerusalem, they put a mosque.
But then the Hindus respond with the same edifice complex. They want to go knock those mosques down and put a temple back up there.
J.D. Dalmia in India is the cement king. And in front of the Mathura, the birthplace of Krishna mosque, he built a dharmshala so high that you can't see the mosque. But he didn't touch a stone on that mosque.
Hmm.
Otherwise, it'd be riots.
Hmm.
Also, in Indian cities, in India, a mosque facing Mecca will go west.
Hmm.
Well, they'll intentionally put one corner sticking into a road. God forbid any car just chips that, you know, there'll be a riot. So again,
yeah.
Buildings.
Little anti-institute.
Have you ever heard of the tyranny that's going on in the scholastic world of any teacher that even hints at what's called intelligent design? Is losing their position. It's fire.
I think such controversy is inflated. I don't think that's actually the case. Having spent some time in education, both in the secondary schools and in the colleges and universities over the last 20 some odd years, Smith does talk about excluded knowledge and anything that hints at transcendence. Anything that hints at something beyond a scientistic thing is discouraged, but it's not that it's not there, and it's not that they automatically lose their positions. And you see that in many of the school systems, there's actually a lot of the teachers are Christians, and a lot of the people on the school boards are Christians, and so these are controversies. This is the age of Kali, so any controversy, any little controversy that might get somebody attention, and that might get some particular cable news network, that's in air quotes for those of you out there in internet land, that might get them ratings, therefore dollars, is inflated. So this is the age of controversy. And so this business rules supreme. So we shouldn't be surprised by people making such assertions, whether such things are actually happening or not. I mean, there is something like that, and there's this whole thing that the right over the last 25 years or so has painted as political correctness, which is just another bugbear, just another hobgoblin. And now they're talking about, you hear people talking about Sharia law overtaking American civil law. And it's not going to happen. Nobody's even talking about that except the people who want us to be afraid and vote for them and send campaign contributions to them. Everybody's exploiting everybody else. And so we need to take a lot of these things with a pinch of salt, not a grain, but a pinch of salt, and throw it over our left shoulder, and look into them very carefully before we become party to actually inflating this. The trap door is about to open, and I do need to go. Thank you very much for your patience. All glories to Sri Guru.